Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, it's all about the unrest we've seen in the UK this week. We'll speak to former Vice President of Twitter, now known as X, about the impact social media has had on the violence we've seen on our streets.
We'll also confront this idea of two-tier policing and speak to a former senior police officer about whether there is any truth to this idea being peddled by those causing unrest.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, here's the week unwrapped. There's really only one thing to discuss this week, and that's those awful scenes we've seen on the streets of the UK, where far-right thugs have spent the last 7 days trashing up their streets and towns, hurling racist abuse at minority communities and making them feel unsafe, threatened and intimidated. Let's just call it what it is, completely and utterly unacceptable far-right behaviour. There is no room for this in our society. Well, this violence started after the brutal murders of three young girls in Southport, where misinformation spread in the midst of the attack suggested the alleged perpetrator was a Muslim immigrant. It later transpired that the accused was not, having been born in Wales. But this didn't stop those far-right thugs. There's been unrest in cities across the country in all four nations nationally. There have since been arrests that have already led to criminal sentences under special powers used by the police and courts to deter this behaviour. There have even been suggestions by some prosecutors that some of those involved in the arrest could face terrorism charges. Well, thankfully, last night, far-right demonstrations that had been anticipated by the police in dozens of locations across Britain failed to materialise, and peaceful anti-racism protesters instead showed up in force. Ali, it's been an awful, awful week, and there's loads to discuss, and we're going to get into all of that throughout our programme. But I just want to know, what is your takeaway from what you've seen on the streets this week? What or who is to blame for the unrest?
So look, first, I think, let's look at how it all started. And there's plenty of blame to go around insofar as how it all started. We had the awful, brutal, tragic murders of these three little girls, and I just cannot imagine a world in which parents can send little girls to, I think it was a dancing class or something of that kind, and them not coming home. We often, you know, we've been sat in this studio, I certainly have been sat in this studio and lambasted America for all the school shootings that happened, and to see that level of violence here is just tragic to see. But in the wake of that, to then use a tragedy like that to purport an advanced, outright racist, far-right political agendas, and we saw many people, including people like Andrew Tate, who were making all sorts of allegations and spreading all sorts of misinformation. We even had Nigel Farage, who now is an MP, talking about the, you know, I think something in the area of the truth is being held from us. And what ended up happening was this narrative took hold that it was a Muslim immigrant who had committed this crime. And as a result, we saw Southport Mosque targeted, Muslims targeted, ethnic minorities targeted, and we've seen like a wave of far-right protests. It seems like this single incident, which as we find out is not true at all, he wasn't Muslim, he was born in Wales, the accused anyway, and it has sort of lifted the lid on this undercurrent of racist sort of thuggery that's existed in the country. You ask who's to blame. I could tell you it's Nigel Farage, and I could tell you it's the far right, and it's Toby Robinson. But I think we hold some blame. I've been saying this for years. My side of the political aisle, the centre-left to the left, have been petrified about talking about immigration for decades. Because we think it's an argument that we can't win. The Labour Party has, for decades, not Keir Starmer's reaction to these riots. That's not what I'm talking about. Long before Keir Starmer was the leader of the Labour Party, we've been petrified to talk about immigration because we think it's a vote loser, and we've left that space empty for the far right to take hold. And when people have an immense amount of economic angst And someone like Nigel Farage steps in and goes, you know what, when you're sat in the waiting room of that hospital and a family that looks different to you gets seen first, that's wrong. And these people are taking over the country. That's not an excuse for the thuggery. The far right thuggery is disgusting. The targeting of minority communities is outright racism. The targeting of Muslims is outright Islamophobia. And all the people who have committed it should be face the full face of the law. And in fact, I think the politicians and the media personalities who have perpetuated it also have some responsibility. But I think it would be foolish for us not to look at ourselves, because the country is clearly in a very vulnerable state. And I think it'd be foolish for us to not look at ourselves and see how we have perpetuated it. The reality is, I can tell you for outright fact that the Islamophobia that we've seen and some of the comments that I have seen and taken is not just confined to the far right. There's nothing I've heard in terms of Islamophobia in the far right that I haven't heard in the green rooms of media organizations that I've been in. There's nothing I've not heard in the Labour Party from other Labour Party members. So I think it'd be foolish to just say it's confined to Farage's far right. They hold, I think, the majority of the culpability. But I think all of us need to reflect on where we are, because the country is hurting.
My view is very similar to yours. And the thing I feel quite strongly is that, yes, the immigration system in this country is flawed, like many things in this country are flawed. So the health service is flawed now. The housing system is flawed. You know, nothing really works. The reason that the immigration system doesn't work is because the Tory government stopped processing asylum seekers and left them holed up in hotels and barges. They left the EU, so left the returns agreement we had with Europe, so that if somebody came here on a sort of clandestine, undocumented, you know, via a small boat or the back of the lorry, they could be sent back to the country they arrived in Europe. We're not in that anymore. We can't do that. When people arrive, they claim asylum. And we are absolutely an economy that is dependent on legal migrants. You know, our health service is understaffed. Our hospitality sector has been decimated by Brexit. But that doesn't in any way, that is in no way the fault of the people who come here seeking a better life. I think the thing that is really missing and has paved the way for so much of this far-right rhetoric is talking about immigration without talking about immigrants and why they come to the UK. So many people come here in search of a better life. Asylum seekers, so many of them are fleeing war, persecution, civil unrest.
Wars that we've started.
We have talked about them in a way where we have dehumanised them and demonised them. And it has got to a point where broadcasters are having conversations about migrants as if they are all criminals, as if they are, you know, it's appalling the level of discourse we've reached.
And that atmosphere allows the misinformation about the Southport attack to break through and cause the unrest that we have.
Absolutely. All the ground was fertile and ready for something to become the kindling. And now what we have seen, you're right, we are reaping the results of a situation that the media class, everybody, politicians are responsible for.
I say the Labour Party and politicians have refused to talk about immigration. I think the media has as well, because you know, we're in this like post nuance, post truth world where the media doesn't really want to talk about something that it can't give a sort of balanced debate on, and so all you end up having is silos where people go to have their existing views reinforced to them. Places like GB News, for example, giving people like Nigel Farage a show, and then the same on the other side of the spectrum, and so we don't end up having an actual meaningful conversation around it. And I think that has definitely fertilized the ground on which we stand now. The question is, look, in a couple of weeks, I think these protests, these riots, by protest I mean the anti-racist protests and the riots, will pretty much die down, I think. But we'll have a question for the country. Do we just go back to that status quo where we either don't talk about immigration and migrants, or we continue to talk about them in the racist sort of undertones ways that we have, and continue the divide, continue the perpetuation of this sort of underbelly of racism in the country? Or do we reflect and go, you know what, something serious has happened in the country and we need to change the way that we talk about migrants and immigration? Nothing. And the level of Islamophobia in the country, by the way, like it's unbelievable to me that a mosque was attacked directly as a result of direct misinformation, and we haven't had a serious conversation about the anti-Muslim racism that exists in the country. Some of the surveys coming out are horrific, and nothing perpetuates that more than I saw Zahra Sultana on GB News with Ed Balls and others just sneering at her. She talks about Islamophobia. Ed is part of the problem, and that sort of atmosphere is part of the problem as to why we're here. So the question we'll have in a couple of weeks when this all dies down is, do we go back to the norm and the status quo, or do we actually have a serious conversation about fixing where our country is?
So let's talk about Labour's immigration policy, because they are now in government. And they, as we both agreed, now need to be really responsible about how they talk about immigration. But they also need to have an immigration policy. Now, I would argue, I think Labour's actually got a fairly strong immigration policy, in that they have set out a number of things, one of which is they're going to be working with European neighbours to basically work on the people who come over here on small boats, to try and smash the criminal gangs. I mean, I hate that phrase, but that's what they always say, trying to really get to that root cause of people coming across on those, making those dangerous journeys. I wonder what else you think, because one of the things that's missing for me is safe and legal routes. Until you open safe and legal routes, people will still make that dangerous journey. So safe and legal routes is missing. What else is missing from Labour's immigration policy that could make it a more sustainable and compassionate but also workable immigration policy, so that people in this country will like?
So let's, I just need to separate it out. One of the elements that I think Labour needs to do is a little bit more wishy-washy. It's not direct politics, but it's that word narrative. I think we need to change the way we talk about immigration and migrants. And then the second is actual policy that you can do. The first one, I think, is actually far more impactful than policy in terms of the divide that exists in our country. Labour needs to change the way that we talk about immigration and migrants, speak with a bit more confidence, with a bit more facts, and in defence of migrants, and what they bring and what we all bring to the country. Let's not forget, I'm a refugee, what people bring to this country. As long as we're afraid to tackle the subject, then the divide in the country will continue. And I think that needs a radical change in the way that we talk about migration and immigration. On policy, I think you're absolutely right. We've inherited an absolute mess, right? The backlog of cases is unbelievably high. I don't know really what the Tories were playing out with the immigration system. Rwanda was just a Hail Mary racist policy to kind of deal with the problem that they'd created. But the, the number one issue is absolutely safe and legal routes, better partnerships with European migrants. The safe and legal routes, let's be clear for people listening. People think that that means unlimited immigration, open borders. That's not what that means. Look, the reality is there are people who are fleeing war, persecution, oppression, often in places that we have had a hand in, who are coming to this country to seek refuge, right? They're going to come here. And historically, people ask, why don't they just stay in France, for example? Well, there's a number of reasons. One, they often speak the language, English. They have family existent here. They believe that they'll have a safer, better life here. France has often they're Muslims, and France has, as bad as we have, probably much worse, an Islamophobic culture where Muslims aren't seen as safe. So there's a myriad of reasons as to why they choose to come to the UK, but they're coming here anyway, right? The question is, do some of them drown in the English Channel on the way here, or do we provide them safe and legal routes and then process them once they're here? The other question is, the UK does not allow you to seek asylum in a third world, in a third country. You have to come here to seek asylum. And I think there needs to be a question as to whether asylum cases can be processed in embassies in safer countries across the world. So, but you're right. I think, you know, people saying Labour don't have an immigration policy are full of it. It's you're just not paying attention to what Labour's been doing.
This is my point as well. Some of the conversation about people on the right saying only, you know, reform or only the right give us an opportunity to talk about immigration. I would argue Labour is talking about it, but those people don't want to listen. And that's because people, I believe, some of them have swallowed some of the lies peddled by those on the right that immigration is the source of all your all your problems.
But that's what we have to challenge, I think. And that's what there needs to be an injection of courage in our frontline politicians in the Labour Party to say outright, the reason that the NHS waiting times are through the roof isn't because there are more people here and because migrants are taking up your spots. The reason that you can't get your kids into school aren't because there are more migrant children that are taking up the spots in your schools. The reason that you can't get jobs and we have the inflation levels that we have, all this kind of stuff, isn't because of the migrants. It's the economic disparity, the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer. And it's not the migrant family next door. It's the banker that's in the city that's got its hand in your pocket. And you have far a working class family has white family has far more in common with the working class brown family next door than they do with the banker who goes to work in the helicopter. And I think there needs to be a proactive effort to say to the country, listen, look, migrants deserve refuge and life in this country, regardless of what they bring, because human life is valuable intrinsically. But without migrant labor, the NHS would collapse tomorrow. Full stop, no question. This isn't a debate, right? We can't have a difference of opinion on this. This is just fact. The amount of teachers, it could go on and on and on. So there is clearly huge benefit that migration brings to this country. The frontline politicians just need to have the courage to say it.
I absolutely agree with you, Ali. Okay, that is The Week Unwrapped. We're going to get into all those other issues surrounding the riots now. Coming up, does Britain have a two-tier policing system, as some on the right are claiming? And just how should people involved in the unrest we've seen this week be dealt with? We'll discuss more on that with a former head of National Counterterrorism Security Office, Chris Phillips, next.
FUPAR Radio. Politics Uncensored.
I felt like it was a little bit, they wanted to go viral. They wanted the clip to end up on socials and be able to go viral, and there was nothing substantive on it. So to be honest, it kind of pissed me off because I thought it was a throwaway comment made for social media as opposed to actually giving voters information they need when they enter the voting booth.
Totally agree. And I also found the whole, I think he said something about Keir Starmer's strings being pulled by senior members of the Labour Party. I found that slightly conspiratorial.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Girls got to choose which guy to bring, or
yeah,
was it?
Yeah, yeah.
And they went away from all of the other islanders, and that's where Joey and Grace were hooking up mad. And I've seen the headlines the next day. Apparently, producers had to really cut out loads of their saucy antics.
You reckon the train was going in the tunnel?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There was no train strike that night.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be. Like, they see, like, the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be, like, this, like, serious, like, fuckboy, like, laugh. You know what I mean? And then they meet me, and I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, so, tell us a little bit more.
Access all areas, mate.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Have you had any failures with your money?
Spent money on a designer handbag, and literally that designer got cancelled maybe like a week or two after, so it's in my house and I've never worn it out.
That's really sad, but that could be like a unique masterpiece, right? That is one of a kind. They don't make it anymore, so you can.
Oh no, they still make it, but I just don't. Maybe the time of cancellation is probably past now. But at that time, I remember what I just bought it. I said to my sister, I was like, "Can I wear this out?" She's like, "Ola, how are you?" No.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Malani,
and me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, more on the unrest on our streets this week. So, allegations of two-tier policing have gained currency after far-right riots rocked towns and cities across the UK. The phrase is being used to describe the impression that some protests and demonstrations are dealt with more harshly than others. Well, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Mark Rowley has called accusations of two-tier policing, quote, complete nonsense, and said they are putting officers at risk. We operate independently under the law without fear or favour, he told Sky News earlier this week. Is there any truth to this idea of two-tier policing? Have the police policed these protests in a correct and fair way? And as some prosecutors have suggested this week, should we consider these riots domestic terrorism? Well, joining us to discuss this is Chris Phillips, former head of the National Counterterrorism Security Office and a former Detective Chief Inspector in the Metropolitan Police. Thanks so much for joining us, Chris. Let's start with the way these protests have been policed. In your opinion, have the police handled this unrest well?
Well, I think they've handled the unrest as well as they could do in the circumstances. I think they were caught napping, if you like, to begin with. They didn't anticipate this kind of violence. But now they've managed to get themselves organised. I think they've dealt with the last couple of days pretty well. It's a difficult situation. I've been through many riots as a police officer, and you are caught out and you have to react to what's in front of you. And I think the police have done pretty well.
Chris, can I ask, do you think we have enough police officers to deal with this? Because we're now seeing it spread all across the country. And we hope that it's going to die down in the coming days. But if it doesn't, there's been huge questions about whether we have enough police officers in general. Are there enough police officers in the force right now to deal with any further spread?
Absolutely not. There are nowhere near enough police officers in the UK. We were always on a shoestring relative to other countries. You know, if you think of our nearest neighbour, France, they've got many, many more police officers than we have. But we manage, and we've dealt with riots over the years. You have to have, of course, properly trained police officers in riot situations, and that takes quite a long time to do that. It's not something you just pick up a riot shield and go running around with it. We've got an awful lot of police officers now are so disaffected that they're leaving. So we've lost a lot of experience. And we do need to support police officers for one thing, but actually give them the incentive to stay within the police service.
I wanted to ask you about that clip of Sir Mark Rowley. I think it was on Sky News, of him coming out of a Cobra meeting, seemingly quite frustrated. And it wasn't quite clear what happened, but it looked as if he might have knocked away a microphone. What was your impression of that clip? Did it seem like he was frustrated and angry about maybe how the police were being treated, or do you think it was all kind of blown out of proportion?
Well, I actually don't like this habit that journalists have got of shouting questions from the other side of the road or whatever, and sticking microphones in people's faces when they're not there to answer questions. However, it was I think he was completely frustrated. He didn't like the question and was just walking past and decided to do something silly. But yeah, I mean, he will be frustrated because he knows, you know, I was a police officer for 30 years. You're trying to do your best in really difficult circumstances, and being asked silly questions at the wrong time sometimes annoys.
Chris, can I ask, there seems to be a sense that policing in general is at a crisis point in the UK, largely because it's being attacked from all sides. So I think people on the left will talk about institutional racism in the police. Following the Sarah Everard tragedy, there's been questions around misogyny in the police, and now the right are criticising the police in terms of two-tier policing. Are we at a serious crisis point where the population as a whole is losing faith in our police force?
I think the population is losing respect for all of our institutions, and policing is just one of those. I think if you spoke to teachers, that they would tell you that they don't have the respect that they think they should have. You know, we've got doctors and nurses being assaulted in our hospitals, and people don't want to be policed. It's as simple as that. And I personally think that the police have had a really hard time. Yeah, I don't think people realise just how much has been taken away from policing. The government of the last 15 years have basically not funded the police anywhere near as much as they should have done, which has caused our community policing to break down. We don't have community officers very much anymore because all the police stations have been closed and the police officers now are more dealing with response. So they're almost like a fire brigade police rather than being police officers as we've been used to for the last 100 years in our communities.
Chris.
So I think police officers have been really hard done by. I think the lack of respect for law and order, people don't think that they should be told what to do. I think, you know, we're in a difficult situation. Policing is right in the middle of that. And when you have a demoralised police service that's been attacked from all sides, you will get the policing that you deserve.
Chris, can I ask you, be honest with me, if I was a young person thinking about becoming a police officer, given the morale issue that you've talked about, given all the criticism coming from all sides, you were a former detective chief inspector. I'm a young person. I've come to Chris. I'm thinking about becoming a police officer. Would you advise me to do it?
I did 30 years in policing. It was the best job. I couldn't have wished for a better job. I think the last 15 years, unfortunately, the last two governments have destroyed much of what we've known as being our policing style in the UK. I struggle to suggest people joining the police now. But, you know, having said that, I'm hoping that things will change. I'm hoping that, you know, we get young people into the police force that really want to make a difference. It's a great job if you're supported. And unfortunately, many aren't supported these days.
Let me ask you about this two-tier policing theory, for want of a better word, that has been going round. What are your thoughts on this and where do you think it comes from? We've heard it in other contexts before, but it's quite unusual, I think, for white communities to suggest they are over-policed compared to people of colour. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's quite a change, Aaron, isn't it? I think the policing have been overly soft, particularly around the demonstrations that we saw with incidents that probably should have resulted in arrests that weren't. And I do know for a fact that policing you're scared of being labelled a racist as a police officer. You really are. And I think there is they pussyfoot sometimes around offences that should have been dealt with. Let me put it that way. However, there's no such pussyfooting around these demonstrations, these riots that we've seen in the last couple of days. And that's quite right, by the way. You know, they shouldn't be pussy. They should be arresting these people. They should be in prison. So I think we just need to make sure that everyone feels as though they're being policed in the same way. And, you know, if people feel that they're not, then there is some issues. And I think their reality may be quite right.
Chris, when you're talking about there was some pussyfooting around policing, what I was hearing was not in relation to these riots, but other incidents that have happened. Is that correct? And therefore, are you suggesting that there is a two-tier?
So. I do feel sorry for the Leeds incident because I don't think the police there were prepared and they had the resources to deal with it, so they had to withdraw. I don't think they would have done had they had their riot teams available, but they were caught out.
So in essence, you're saying there is a form of two-tier policing. If we're pussyfooting around one kind of incident, but you're saying that they've dealt with these ones correctly, then there is two-tier policing.
Well, I certainly think that other demonstrations should have been dealt with more forcefully. Let me put it that way. I don't think we should have accepted certain things that have happened over the last two or three years. But sometimes you have to make sensible decisions or, you know, decisions to try and keep the peace.
Can you give me an example?
I think certainly when the Jewish community were under real threat over the last year or two, I think police officers should have been much more responsive and dealt with the demonstrators better and harder.
Chris, would you label these incidents over the past week as terrorism? Do you think that some people should be prosecuted under terrorist legislation?
I think all the requirements for a terrorist offence have been committed. Mm. But then again, there are many other types of incident that could have been deemed terrorist incidents over the years, and the government choose not to do that. And I think you've got to be very careful because an awful lot of people have sympathy for the view that immigration has got out of control and our cities are changing not for the better. and I think to label people, start labelling people terrorists is probably a very difficult thing to do. There's plenty of offences that are being committed. You don't need to go into the terrorism legislation for this.
Thanks for joining us, Chris. That was Chris Phillips, former head of the National Counterterrorism Security Office and a former detective chief inspector in the Metropolitan Police.
This is Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Greenewald. We just heard there from Chris Phillips. Ali, that was quite interesting, actually. I didn't really... Yeah, that was interesting. I didn't expect a former police officer to suggest that maybe there was a two-tier police system.
Yeah, so look, what I heard was he does think that there's two-tier policing, but not that the sort of far-right riots are being policed too heavily, but that other protests weren't being policed as heavily as they should be. Now, he mentioned, I suspect, he talked about the Jewish community and in reference to protest, I assume, and again, if I'm mistaken, I apologize, but I assume he's talking about the pro-Palestinian protests that have happened since October 7th. I think any equating of that to far-right rallies is crass and unacceptable, because in one case, you've got mosques being attacked, and you've got police cars being
hotels
burnt,
with asylum seekers being set on fire, yeah.
And in other cases, we've got people chanting for the end of a alleged genocide. I don't think there's any comparison whatsoever. That being said, that doesn't mean that there haven't been incidents in the pro-Palestinian protests of anti-Semitism and Jewish communities feeling under pressure. So if that's what he was saying, he's wrong. When I always talk about the police, and I've sat in this chair, talked about institutional racism in the police, that's both my experience and the data. The Metropolitan Police, we're talking about Metropolitan Police specifically, they issued their own research that found institutional racism and misogyny in the police. So I'm surprised at what I heard, because you'd think he'd defend the police a little bit more of an institution. But that being said, he wasn't in any way insinuating that people were being too hard on these far-right riots and that they weren't being dealt with well. I give him that, absolutely. But more that perhaps in other instances, and I felt like Leeds was more on the front of his mind, the police hadn't been as strong as they should be, which is interesting. I wasn't expecting it.
Ali, would you label the people who took part in the riots and committed some of the worst things we've seen domestic terrorists?
Not all of them. I think I would definitely label targeting a hotel full of migrants and trying to burn it down and putting their lives at risk. Domestic terrorism. I would certainly, the people online, some of the far-right commentators, if I can be kind and call them that, outing hotels that migrants have a heavy presence in, who've been put there by the government, by the way. It's not like the migrants have shown up and gone, we're going to occupy this hotel. It's how the government deal with, or the Tories, the system that the Tories created. And outing these hotels as a way to instigate riots and the burning and the violence at these hotels, I would certainly look at domestic terrorism. It's interesting. I'm not saying he said this, right? Let's be very clear about this. He said all the boxes of terrorism have been ticked, but there are other elements. And I swear to you, instantly my mind went, oh, they're not Muslim. Right? There's no doubt if a group of Muslim protesters targeted a hotel and burnt it to the ground, it wasn't burnt to the ground, but if they did that, there's no question that that would be branded as terrorism. So I wonder if there's a secret unconscious box that says, are they Muslim, before terrorism is ticked. He wasn't saying that, but that was what was in my mind.
Yeah, I found it really interesting. I mean, he was very kind of sort of talked a lot about how respect for the police had been lost.
Yeah, I think that's
lost.
True.
Yes. But, you know, you have to look inwards, right, and be kind of introspective. And I think the police have, as you were saying, undergone a series of crises. And usually they're being attacked from the left. And it's been a real marked change this week, seeing them being attacked from the right.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen the police acting in any way, from the footage I've seen, with excessive force towards people who are throwing bricks at them, hitting them over their head with poles, launching towards them, shouting in their face. You know, I don't really understand where the right thinks it has a leg to stand on this. I think it's really, it just seems to me like the first time they've had a taste of,
yeah,
you know, what it's like for other people.
And this is again where our politics as a whole has become a football team. You wear red, I wear blue, and we throw things at each other. And when my side does something, they're right all the time. Mm. And when your side does something, they're wrong all the time. I think, you know, I have been a big critic of the police. In fact, I got like something like 200 emails the other week when we did an interview with Henry Bolton talking about the police. But I don't think they've done, I think they're in a very difficult position, and I haven't seen anything in which they've done anything wrong here. They're facing an extremely difficult task. Outright violence, cars being burnt, like you said, hotels being targeted, mosques being targeted, bricks being thrown. And I think it's a very difficult task that they've dealt with fairly well. Mm. And I understand Mark Rowley's frustration, right? Because they are now being attacked from all sides. And that's a very, very difficult situation to handle. I maybe wouldn't have taken a journalist's microphone and ripped it out in the way that he'd had.
Mm.
But we're all humans and we have human moments. I would hope I'd never do something like that, but I understand that frustration. But look, overall, I think policing is at a crisis point because policing only works when it has the faith of the community. Policing by consent is what we have believed in this country for as long as I have been alive. And if now you've got a situation where Muslims and ethnic minorities feel the police is institutionally racist and has a two-tier policing system, women see the police as institutionally misogynist after everything we saw with the Sarah Everard case and everything that came after that. And now you see people on the right, a white community, saying there's two-tier policing on us. Mm. That puts policing at a huge crisis point.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, coming up, has social media had a role to play in this unrest? And if so, does social media need more regulation to stop this type of behaviour happening? We're going to speak to the former vice president of Twitter next.
FUBAR Radio.
Politics Uncensored.
I felt like it was a little bit, they wanted to go viral. They wanted the clip to end up on socials and be able to go viral, and there was nothing substantive on it. So to be honest, it kind of pissed me off because I thought it was a throwaway comment made for social media as opposed to actually giving voters information they need when they enter the voting booth.
Totally agree. And I also found the whole, I think you said something about Keir Starmer's strings being pulled by senior members of the Labour Party. I found that slightly conspiratorial.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
Girls got to choose which guy to bring, or
yeah,
was it?
Yeah, yeah.
And they went away from all of the other islanders, and that's where Joey and Grace were hooking up mad. And I've seen the headlines the next day. Apparently, producers had to really cut out loads of their saucy antics.
You reckon the train was going in the tunnel?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There was no train strike that night.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
What the Hell with Gabby Allen.
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be. Like, they see, like, the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be, like, this, like, serious, like, fuckboy, like, laugh. You know what I mean? And then they meet me, and I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, tell us a little bit more.
Access All Areas, mate.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Have you had any failures with your money?
Spent money on a designer handbag and literally that designer got cancelled maybe like a week or two after, so it's in my house and I've never worn it out.
That's really sad. But that could be like a unique masterpiece, right? That is one of a kind. They don't make it anymore. So you can.
Oh, no, they still make it. But I just don't. Maybe the time of cancellation is probably past now. But at that time, I remember what I just bought it. I said to my sister, I was like, can I wear this out? She's like, Ola, how are you? No.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, social media companies have been told to, quote, act now to remove harmful online content about the UK riots. The regulator Ofcom has said the government has accused social media companies of fueling the protests, which were prompted by false claims that the suspect in the killing of three girls in Southport was an asylum seeker. Well, earlier I spoke to Bruce Daisley, former vice president of Twitter between 2015 and 2020.
I think there's no doubt it's played a contributory factor. It's I don't think it's possible for us to pinpoint exactly the root cause of everything or to ascribe percentages, but certainly X and misinformation on X has, and on other social networks, but particularly X, has contributed to, I think, the intensity of this whole situation stepping up again. So I definitely think it's played a part. And we can just see examples from that. The speculation over the identity of the original attacker certainly contributed to a group of people with an already existing perspective to indulge their prejudice. And I certainly think the free flow of misinformation contributed to that.
There's long been talk that social media would give rise to all kinds of perspectives. And there are some people who argue that this is just an inevitable consequence of social media, that you know, the spread of conspiracy theories or people saying kind of objectionable and horrible things is just an inevitable part of social media. You were vice president of Twitter back in 2015 to 2020. Do you think it's inevitable? Would you have tried when you were in that role to prevent some of this stuff from taking place, or is it just part of it?
Oh, in the era I was there, there was a real care. No, I think it's it's worth saying that it wasn't perfect in that era. In fact, you know, many of us who worked there spent a lot of time lobbying to maybe try to make some of the restrictions on some of the horrible stuff, the negative stuff, worse. And specifically what I mean by that is that, you know, there was a strong view that you just shouldn't be allowed to come onto a platform and abuse a stranger. Mm. Simple thing, you can't send a swear word to a stranger. Now, that might seem trivial, and, you know, some people could dress that up as you're restricting my free speech. But I don't think there's many Wetherspoons pubs you could walk up to a stranger and call them the C word and continue with your evening. So it's just about a degree of nicety. But, you know, certainly we didn't fully have that rule in place. But it was one of the things that we fought for. Okay, but we're in a situation now where when you run a social network, I guess one of the things that it's impossible to do, say if you've got a billion tweets every day, then you can't pre-read them, you can't pre-check them. But what you can do is that when people say, I've just been insulted or abused or attacked, you can allow them to flag that and someone will review it. One of the first things that Elon Musk did is he got rid of all of that team. So he got rid of the team who would review reported tweets. And so you see now quite regularly on the timeline, people saying, I reported someone who called me this and it's come back and there's no issue. I saw someone today saying a person had posted their home address three times and said, let's go around and attack this person. He'd reported it and he was told that there was no issue. So Musk firstly got rid of the lifeguards, you know, to use the metaphor, the lifeguards sitting in the high chairs, making sure that nothing too bad happens. In addition to that, probably in my era there and in all social networks, there's a degree of trying to de-escalate some of the worst content, de-amplify some of the worst content. Now, the way you hear this often described is people will say, I've been shadow banned. And the uses of that, there's a wide range of uses of that. I know that some people have believed that sometimes progressive politics is shadow banned on Instagram, for example. But the way that shadow banning typically works is that you just decide that you're not going to allow certain posts to be algorithmically pushed into people's timelines. And the reason why you might do that at times is you might say, okay, this is either someone who's got a lot of complaints against them, or this is someone who appears to have had a number of abuse strikes, so they've said a lot of bad things. And so what we're not going to do is we're not going to escalate them. So typically the victims of things like that might have been spammers, or they might have been in the past people like Katie Hopkins, mm-hmm. who kind of cultivate this aura of negativity, deliberately attacking other people. And all you would try to do, you know, the mere fact I'm talking about this, people believe that I'm sort of a censor in chief. But all you would try to do is remove some of the toxicity overall of the ecosystem by just getting rid of the negative voices. So look, we could debate it long and hard, but typically that's what you would have done. Under Musk, the opposite has happened. So if someone posts something as they did yesterday saying, oh, Keir Starmer's going to set up these containment camps, of course, there's a certain group of people who will be so inflamed by that, they'll post about it, they'll comment on it, they'll share it. And the algorithm will start doing some magic. Once something has proved to be a hit, it will start pushing it to more people. I guess, so my point is, typically in the past, shadow banning would prevent the worst content reaching a wide audience. And the way we used to describe it is that it's a contrast between equality, it's a contrast between freedom of speech and freedom of reach. So anyone can say what they want. You can go to their timeline and see they've said it. But what we're not going to do is we're not going to take the adrenaline that's created, and we're not going to allow it to cascade into more people's social media feeds.
So Elon Musk has presided over this kind of new era of X, which has seen more of these kind of these statements that people are making online spread. As you mentioned earlier, he's also shared this fake article about Keir Starmer building detainment camps. He's engaged on social media with figures like Tommy Robinson, who is a very influential figure on the far right and has been blamed for helping to fan the flames of disinformation around these around the far right riots. Do you think Elon Musk should be held criminally responsible for some of the events that have happened over the past week?
Yeah, I do. I think he should be. It's worth saying that there are two different strands to this. Him as the owner of a platform, and he is liable to the new incoming Online Safety Act. It's not implemented yet, but there's no reason to suggest that Ofcom couldn't say we are now starting to a period of monitoring in regard to that, because it's now it's part of law, it's passed royal assent. So he's liable there. But in addition, in the same way that Andrew Tate is liable, in the same way that Lawrence Fox is liable, or that we're all liable, I don't mean to sort of single them out, we're all liable. And if we inflame racial hatred, any degree of hatred, if we treat the social media as different to the real world, then we'll make a mistake. He should be criminally liable. The Online Safety Act says that other people are as well. So, you know, it's worth saying that, okay, so albeit that the company's not based in the UK, there are a lot of people who visit the UK, who are from the UK, the head of global policy there, so the person who's responsible for what conversation looks like on the platform, is a guy called Nick Pickles. And all of these people should be held criminally responsible for what's happening on the platform.
The Director of Public Prosecution, Stephen Parkinson, has reminded members of the public to be mindful of what they are saying and sharing online, and has warned them they could face prosecution if they repost, repeat or amplify a message which is false, threatening or stirs up racial or religious hatred. At what point does this will the public feel as if they are having their own freedom of speech impinged upon? Is there quite an easy line where we can say, you can't post that, that is criminally, you know, you could be held criminally liable for that? Or is it actually quite complex?
I think inevitably, any time that you take any action on this, you're going to have some people who agree with you and some people who disagree with you. I don't think there's any scenario where you arrest someone for what they said online and people are united in a sense that that was the right thing to do. So we're inevitably going to see a polarization here. And in fact, you know, when I've tweeted about these things, I've had a lot of people saying to me, generally people with anonymous accounts with not many followers, but they say to me, why are you trying to silence me? Why are you trying to silence discussion? Now, so we're not going to please everyone with this. So what we've got to do is we've got to decide what we think is right, what we think is the responsible way for platforms like this to operate, and recognize that not everyone's going to agree. My view in particular is that, you know, you shouldn't treat the internet as different to the real world. If you say something toxic, abusive, aggressive to another person, then it's precisely the same as saying that to them in the street. And you know, there should be sanction for that. If you do something more than that, if you try and you know, create a threat to other people, then clearly that's even more serious.
I just want to ask you one last question. I'm sure, like a lot of people on Twitter, my mentions are filled with abusive comments from a lot of people called Bob 1234567 8. Lots and lots of people without proper names, no evidence of their location, no profile picture. How many of these people are bots? And if they are bots, where are they coming from?
A really interesting question, isn't it? I think, you know, Musk's whole manifesto, if he represented anything, when he came in, he said he was going to sort the spam. And one of the ways he tried to wriggle out of buying Twitter after he'd signed on the dotted line was to say there's too much spam, there's too many of these automated voices. They seem to have got substantially worse. I don't know. For me, I wouldn't allow a social media account to be my first name and 8 digits. It just doesn't seem like it's trying to capture anything about the essence of my identity. Yes, there does seem to be something odd about it. But, you know, when you interact with these people, they do reply. I wonder if it's not necessarily always just bots, but it's multiple accounts being operated by the same person. So I guess, you know, the easy thing for us to say is that it's bots, but probably a better way to think about it is that it's sort of someone who's got TweetDeck or something open and they've got 30 different alter egos. That's definitely what we've seen in the past when state actors have got involved in this sort of stuff. So I hear you. And you know, look, you know, the perennial debate is, should you have to put your personal details in? Should you have to put your real name in? And look, there are platforms where you have to do that. Facebook typically has always been pretty insistent on trying to capture something close to your real name. The discussion has always been that actually allowing people to have an alter ego, allowing them to sort of use the internet in a more frivolous way, does have some positive upsides at times. You know, you don't always want your name attached to you posting about the pop music you're obsessed with, or, you know, the football team you're obsessed with. I strongly can see that argument. But I guess what we're recognising is that maybe there should be the freedom to only interact with the verified ones, you know, the people who've proved who they are, because you just don't want the abuse of the other side. So I can definitely see the sort of the full benefit. But I can see that, you know, some people might just want to go on and post about their favourite pop group, and they don't necessarily want that to follow them around for the rest of their life. So, you know, there is a benefit to some degree of anonymity.
So we just heard there from Bruce Daisley, who was the former vice president of Twitter. Ali, what do you think of that? Should Elon Musk, he said he thinks Elon Musk should potentially be criminally liable. Do you agree?
Yeah, he's openly inciting, in his words, civil war in our country as a foreign person. I think one of the things that's really interesting about what we didn't hear in this interview was he's talking about people having multiple accounts. We now have verified reports of countries, states, employing hundreds and hundreds of people in rows and rows and rows, sat there operating multiple accounts, spreading misinformation here in the UK and across in the US as a political tool to either influence elections or to sow unrest. We saw that with the fake pizza situation with Hillary's campaign, and a lot of the misinformation actually out of Southport was linked to websites abroad and misinformation from those things. So I think where he's absolutely right is that there should be no criminal legal difference between saying something out loud to someone in the streets, in a pub or anything like that, versus saying it online. Those should have the exact same legal consequences as anything else. And I think the sooner that's applied to social media, the better. Well, that's it from Politics Uncensored today. Zoe, it has been so good to have you back. You look very good and well rested after your holiday. So I hope we've got you for the foreseeable future. You're not allowed to go on holiday, is basically what I'm saying. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can also find me at Ali Maloney UK.
And you can find me on X, if you want to, if you're still there, at Zoe _ Grunewald.
I'm sure Roger 3684562 will also be messaging you by the end of the day. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com. Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored. Salams.